Hello. This is the IGCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test, Summer 2009.
This test is in three sections. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three sections twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen.
Section A. In this section, you will hear the principal of a school telling the students about the arrangements for sports day. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than three words and or a number for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good morning, everyone. As Sports Day next month will be at a new location, I want to take a moment to tell you about the arrangements. We will be sending letters to your parents this week with all the details. As our sports facilities are under repair, the event will be held at Newhouse Sports Field on the 17th. That's the public facility in the west of town. Instead of our usual whole-day programme, this year we will only be devoting a morning to the event, starting at 9:15 and ending at 12:45. Seating will be very limited, so we will be asking parents to bring their own folding chairs. We will be sitting under sunshading, and you will need to bring something to sit on, such as a plastic sheet or similar. However, make sure it is small enough to fit into a small bag. Refreshments will be available to parents and visitors in a tent next to the pavilion. They will be able to buy hot and cold drinks and snacks. You will not be able to use this facility, so please bring a packed lunch in a disposable bag and a drink in a plastic bottle. Prefects will be responsible for collecting all rubbish at the end of the competition. If the weather is poor and it turns out to be an unsuitable day, for example, the ground is so wet that it is too unsafe to run on grass, we will switch sports day from the Tuesday to the Wednesday, and hope it doesn't rain then. If the weather is hot and sunny, which would be nice, please make sure you wear a sun barrier cream and a hat, and bring extra water. On the day, you should come to school as usual in your uniform and bring your PE kit with you. You will change at school, and teachers will issue you with shirts in the house colours. We will be getting to the venue by coach. As we have had to reduce the sports day programme, we will only have the final of each event on the day. So, the qualifying heats will be organised to take place in PE lessons between now and then. We will also have our all-school events of tunnel ball and captain ball as usual, as well as the traditional parents, staff and students' races. Prize giving will take place at the pavilion immediately after the last race at about 12:15, and I'm pleased to tell you that Dr. Westgate, a former Olympic runner, will present the prizes and House Cup. After the prizes, the coaches will return to school, but you may also go home with your parents, as there will be no lessons in the afternoon. Please note, however, if you are offered transport home by a classmate, you must inform your class teacher first, before you leave the grounds. Lastly, could you warn your parents of the parking problems at New House? The car park is very small, so they will need to use the supermarket 300 metres past the main entrance to the ground.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Good morning, everyone. As Sports Day next month will be at a new location, I want to take a moment to tell you about the arrangements. We will be sending letters to your parents this week with all the details. As our sports facilities are under repair, the event will be held at New House Sports Field on the 17th. That's the public facility in the west of town. Instead of our usual whole-day program, this year we will only be devoting a morning to the event, starting at 9:15 and ending at 12:45. Seating will be very limited, so we will be asking parents to bring their own folding chairs. We will be sitting under sunshading, and you will need to bring something to sit on, such as a plastic sheet or similar. However, make sure it is small enough to fit into a small bag. Refreshments will be available to parents and visitors in a tent next to the pavilion. They will be able to buy hot and cold drinks and snacks. You will not be able to use this facility, so please bring a packed lunch in a disposable bag and a drink in a plastic bottle. Prefects will be responsible for collecting all rubbish at the end of the competition. If the weather is poor and it turns out to be an unsuitable day, for example, the ground is so wet that it is too unsafe to run on grass, we will switch sports day from the Tuesday to the Wednesday and hope it doesn't rain then. If the weather is hot and sunny, which would be nice, please make sure you wear a sun barrier cream and a hat, and bring extra water. On the day, you should come to school as usual in your uniform and bring your PE kit with you. You will change at school, and teachers will issue you with shirts in the house colours. We will be getting to the venue by coach. As we have had to reduce the Sports Day programme, we will only have the final of each event on the day. So, the qualifying heats will be organised to take place in PE lessons between now and then. We will also have our all-school events of tunnel ball and captain ball as usual, as well as the traditional parents, staff and students' races. Prize giving will take place at the pavilion immediately after the last race at about 12:15. And I'm pleased to tell you that Dr. Westgate, a former Olympic runner, will present the prizes and House Cup. After the prizes, the coaches will return to school, but you may also go home with your parents, as there will be no lessons in the afternoon. Please note, however, if you are offered transport home by a classmate, you must inform your class teacher first, before you leave the grounds. Lastly, could you warn your parents of the parking problems at New House? The car park is very small, so they will need to use the supermarket 300 metres past the main entrance to the ground.
That's the end of Section A. Now turn to Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear a radio interview with Frederick Stanthorpe, an Antarctic explorer and scientist, discussing tourism to the continent. Listen and answer the questions. Indicate your answer by marking the box. If you change your mind, put a line through the box and then indicate your new answer with a cross. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions. Good morning, and welcome to the science interview. Today, Frederick Stanthorpe, explorer and scientist, who first set foot on Antarctica in 1946, will tell us about the impact of tourism on the continent. Frederick, could we start with a few facts and figures?
Yes, well, it has been about 50 years since the first cruise ship visited with 200 passengers, but now about 30,000 tourists go each year.
How did you and other scientists feel about Antarctic tourism when it began in the late 1950s?
Every scientist I knew, including myself, was very much against it. We thought tourists would almost certainly get in the way and interfere with the scientific program of monitoring ice formation and wildlife. We were down there doing things the hard way, basking in the glory of polar exploration, and resented the idea that people could simply pay to visit the continent. A lot of scientists still feel that the presence of tourists affects them adversely.
Do you still resent tourists?
My views changed in the early 1960s, when I met an 80-year-old passenger who had just returned from a trip on one of the first cruise ships to Antarctica. She knew all about my research into the decline of a population of emperor penguins. I realized that we needed people like her to protect the continent. Allowing people to visit Antarctica encourages a public interest in polar conservation. I have always found Antarctica a very interesting and moving place, and I now wouldn't dream of trying to prevent other people from sharing that experience, just so long as it can be done in a controlled manner.
How well controlled is the tourist industry?
The model for shipborne Antarctic tourism, which carries well over 95% of tourists to the continent, was created by an American tour operator, who took great care to ensure his operations caused no damage. It was genuine environmental concern on his part, and it also helped to sell tickets. He took Antarctic experts aboard as lecturers and guides. All Antarctic cruise operators use this model, and new operators are strongly encouraged to adopt it. The Arctic operators could learn from this approach. I visited Arctic cruise liners that were more like holiday camps, with little effort made to stimulate interest in the place. We had visitors coming ashore with no idea where they were. They were missing much and damaging the environment because no one had briefed them.
Since 1992, your research has focused on the impact of Antarctic tourism. What have you found?
there is no strong evidence that tourism has had a significant impact on the plants, wildlife, or landscape of Antarctica. On the whole, I believe the tourists have done far less damage than some of the scientists who have had the run of the place since 1950. They leave an awful mess. Workers are brought in to build bases all over the place, and they aren't that bad at tidying up after themselves, although they could do better.
How have scientists damaged the environment?
The U.S. Antarctic Program recently created a 16,000-kilometer snow road from the coast to the South Pole station. This allows them to resupply the station by tractor rather than aircraft. It's unthinkable that tourists could have this kind of impact. Another example, admittedly not quite so serious in its effects, is that scientists have had hotels put up for the workers at their bases. But if a tour operator said it was going to put up a hotel, well, there would be an outcry. What would be strongly opposed for a tourist group is accepted almost without question for a scientific group.
How are activities controlled in Antarctica?
Scientists are controlled by an agreement which governments with interests in Antarctica have signed. Under the agreement, the Antarctica Commission is responsible for checking scientific activity. Tourism remains virtually uncontrolled, except by the industry itself. This is fine so long as the industry is small, but it is growing all the time, and it has the potential to get out of hand. Nowadays you can find as many as 40 ships operating around Antarctica in the summer. Climate change is likely to open up more sites to more people for more of the year.
How can this expansion be contained?
A commission has been created to control fishing, so it should be able to do the same for tourism. The commission could, for example, check that a ship is properly run before allowing it to go to the Antarctic. It would need to act very quickly, particularly in the big ship sector, cruise ships that do not land. The first 1,000-passenger liner travelled to Antarctica in 2000. Four of them went there in the 2004-2005 season, and last year, for the first time, a 3,000-passenger cruise ship visited.
How dangerous is the Antarctic for such large ships?
No ship is immune to dangers at sea, but in many ways a big, well-equipped modern liner is safer for its passengers than a smaller one. Whether it is ice-strengthened is neither here nor there. Dozens of fishing ships that are not ice-strengthened operate every year in ice-strewn waters. What matters is how the ship is handled, and I would trust the master of a big cruise liner, backed by an experienced ice captain, to know his job very thoroughly.
What if a ship gets into trouble?
If a small vessel gets into difficulty in Antarctic waters, it can be a relatively easy business to get its 100 or so passengers into lifeboats, and with several other ships likely to be in the area, they can be picked up fairly quickly. We saw this after the loss of a cruise ship in November last year. If a big ship were to get into difficulty in similar circumstances, getting well over 1,000 passengers and crew off quickly would be the biggest problem, and even half a dozen smaller ships would have difficulty transporting them to safety. There seems to be little provision for such an eventuality, and if it were to happen, it could become a disaster on a scale never seen in Antarctica.
Frederick Stanthorpe, thank you very much. Now listen a second time and check your answers. Good morning, and welcome to the science interview. Today, Frederick Stanthorpe, explorer and scientist, who first set foot on Antarctica in 1946, will tell us about the impact of tourism on the continent. Frederick, Could we start with a few facts and figures?
Yes. Well, it has been about 50 years since the first cruise ship visited with 200 passengers. But now about 30,000 tourists go each year.
How did you and other scientists feel about Antarctic tourism when it began in the late 1950s?
Every scientist I knew, including myself, was very much against it. We thought tourists would almost certainly get in the way and interfere with the scientific program of monitoring ice formation and wildlife. We were down there doing things the hard way, basking in the glory of polar exploration, and resented the idea that people could simply pay to visit the continent. A lot of scientists still feel that the presence of tourists affects them adversely.
Do you still resent tourists?
My views changed in the early 1960s, when I met an 80-year-old passenger who had just returned from a trip on one of the first cruise ships to Antarctica. She knew all about my research into the decline of a population of emperor penguins. I realized that we needed people like her to protect the continent. Allowing people to visit Antarctica encourages a public interest in polar conservation. I have always found Antarctica a very interesting and moving place, and I now wouldn't dream of trying to prevent other people from sharing that experience, just so long as it can be done in a controlled manner.
How well controlled is the tourist industry?
The model for shipborne Antarctic tourism, which carries well over 95% of tourists to the continent, was created by an American tour operator, who took great care to ensure his operations caused no damage. It was genuine environmental concern on his part, and it also helped to sell tickets. He took Antarctic experts aboard as lecturers and guides. All Antarctic cruise operators use this model, and new operators are strongly encouraged to adopt it. The Arctic operators could learn from this approach. I visited Arctic cruise liners that were more like holiday camps, with little effort made to stimulate interest in the place. We had visitors coming ashore with no idea where they were. They were missing much and damaging the environment because no one had briefed them.
Since 1992, your research has focused on the impact of Antarctic tourism. What have you found?
There is no strong evidence that tourism has had a significant impact on the plants, wildlife, or landscape of Antarctica. On the whole, I believe the tourists have done far less damage than some of the scientists who have had the run of the place since 1950. They leave an awful mess. Workers are brought in to build bases all over the place, and they aren't that bad at tidying up after themselves, although they could do better.
How have scientists damaged the environment?
The U.S. Antarctic Program recently created a 16,000-kilometer snow road from the coast to the South Pole Station. This allows them to resupply the station by tractor rather than aircraft. It's unthinkable that tourists could have this kind of impact. Another example, admittedly not quite so serious in its effects, is that scientists have had hotels put up for the workers at their bases. But if a tour operator said it was going to put up a hotel, well, there would be an outcry. What would be strongly opposed for a tourist group is accepted almost without question for a scientific group.
How are activities controlled in Antarctica?
Scientists are controlled by an agreement which governments with interests in Antarctica have signed. Under the agreement, the Antarctica Commission is responsible for checking scientific activity. Tourism remains virtually uncontrolled, except by the industry itself. This is fine so long as the industry is small, but it is growing all the time, and it has the potential to get out of hand. Nowadays you can find as many as 40 ships operating around Antarctica in the summer. Climate change is likely to open up more sites to more people for more of the year.
How can this expansion be contained?
A commission has been created to control fishing, so it should be able to do the same for tourism. The commission could, for example, check that a ship is properly run before allowing it to go to the Antarctic. It would need to act very quickly, particularly in the big ship sector, cruise ships that do not land. The first 1,000-passenger liner travelled to Antarctica in 2000. Four of them went there in the 2004-2005 season, and last year, for the first time, a 3,000-passenger cruise ship visited.
How dangerous is the Antarctic for such large ships?
No ship is immune to dangers at sea, but in many ways a big, well-equipped modern liner is safer for its passengers than a smaller one. Whether it is ice-strengthened is neither here nor there. Dozens of fishing ships that are not ice-strengthened operate every year in ice-strewn waters. What matters is how the ship is handled, and I would trust the master of a big cruise liner, backed by an experienced ice captain, to know his job very thoroughly.
What if a ship gets into trouble?
If a small vessel gets into difficulty in Antarctic waters, it can be a relatively easy business to get its 100 or so passengers into lifeboats, and with several other ships likely to be in the area, they can be picked up fairly quickly. We saw this after the loss of a cruise ship in November last year. If a big ship were to get into difficulty in similar circumstances, getting well over 1,000 passengers and crew off quickly would be the biggest problem, and even half a dozen smaller ships would have difficulty transporting them to safety. There seems to be little provision for such an eventuality, and if it were to happen, it could become a disaster on a scale never seen in Antarctica.
Frederick Stanthorpe, thank you very much. That's the end of Section B. Now turn to Section C. Section C. In this section, you will hear a talk about our emotions and how to manage them. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than two words and or a number for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
We all know that a dark mood can ruin a perfectly good day, just as a bright one can make any situation seem better. But did you realise that moods have the power to make us well or ill? More and more research is linking emotions and health. But which moods have what effects? And how can you control them? Anger is a powerful emotion. whether it manifests itself in explosive outbursts or being generally irritable. And it has a powerful effect on the body, too. In evolutionary terms, anger was a call to action, triggering the fight or flight response, flooding your body with hormones, and raising your heart rate and blood pressure. This kind of physical reaction is fine if you have to fight or flee, but repeated feelings of anger become damaging if they have no physical outlet. Numerous studies have linked this kind of recurring anger to digestive and skin complaints. Last year, research published in the journal Health Psychology found that angry men had higher levels of a blood chemical linked to heart disease, while a study at Ohio State University in the US showed hostile young adults displayed more breathing difficulties than other more relaxed people of a similar age. We all get angry, so what can we do to control it? The key is to manage it. Now, if you feel happy, you often feel energetic, which in turn means you're more likely to do exercise such as swimming or going to the gym. But scientists have also found health benefits that arise from good moods alone. In one recent study, psychologists exposed a large group of adults to the cold virus and discovered that those with generally positive outlooks reported fewer symptoms. We need to look more seriously at the possibility that a person's emotional state has a significant effect on their chances of falling ill. A study of British government workers in 2005 provides evidence to support this view. It also found that the happiest participants were in better health than their more miserable colleagues. And as the same study showed, the opposite of the good mood, good health equation is also true. Negative and pessimistic feelings have been linked to poor sleep, tiredness, and health problems. So how do we feel more positive? The answer is to find perspective. There may be some things that are not as you want them to be, and it is fine to accept that. But it is irrational to only see the negative. If necessary, draw up a written list of positive things so that you can focus on the broader picture, which is that some things are difficult, but many are not. Gratitude is one emotion that a team of psychologists in California has been researching for over a decade. During a recent study, those who tried to develop a greater sense of gratitude reported fewer physical problems, such as pain, saw a positive effect on sleep and on time spent exercising, and had more optimistic expectations for the coming week. So how can we develop a feeling of gratitude? You can be thankful for anything, your family, your well-being, or just being alive. The key is to be thankful all the time, rather than only as a response to a specific event. In fact, developing a permanent sense of gratitude is essential. In studies, participants were asked to keep a weekly gratitude journal, noting down everything they felt grateful for. The result was fewer physical problems and a greater sense of optimism. Let me finish by giving you some general advice on how to manage your emotions. Most importantly, stop negative emotions in their tracks. The longer you let them control your thoughts, the longer you'll suffer, psychologically and physically. If you find yourself about to have an argument or are feeling stressed, remove yourself from the situation and find a quiet spot. Take up to 15 deep breaths. Try to calm yourself with the reassurance that all is well and you are in control. This can lower your heartbeat rate and blood pressure almost immediately. If you're having an argument, walk back into the room for a discussion. If that isn't possible, leave. It's important to reduce stress. If you're working yourself up with tight deadlines, just cross off the last three items on your to-do list. Deep breathing is a vital part of turning around your feelings. Breathe deeply for a few minutes, and you should relax and let go of worries.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
We all know that a dark mood can ruin a perfectly good day, just as a bright one can make any situation seem better. But did you realize that moods have the power to make us well or ill? More and more research is linking emotions and health. But which moods have what effects, and how can you control them? Anger is a powerful emotion, whether it manifests itself in explosive outbursts or being generally irritable. And it has a powerful effect on the body, too. In evolutionary terms, anger was a call to action, triggering the fight or flight response, flooding your body with hormones, and raising your heart rate and blood pressure. This kind of physical reaction is fine if you have to fight or flee, but repeated feelings of anger become damaging if they have no physical outlet. Numerous studies have linked this kind of recurring anger to digestive and skin complaints. Last year, research published in the journal Health Psychology found that angry men had higher levels of a blood chemical linked to heart disease, while a study at Ohio State University in the US showed hostile young adults displayed more breathing difficulties than other more relaxed people of a similar age. We all get angry, so what can we do to control it? The key is to manage it. Now, if you feel happy, you often feel energetic, which in turn means you're more likely to do exercise such as swimming or going to the gym. But scientists have also found health benefits that arise from good moods alone. In one recent study, psychologists exposed a large group of adults to the cold virus and discovered that those with generally positive outlooks reported fewer symptoms. We need to look more seriously at the possibility that a person's emotional state has a significant effect on their chances of falling ill. A study of British government workers in 2005 provides evidence to support this view. It also found that the happiest participants were in better health than their more miserable colleagues. And as the same study showed, the opposite of the good mood, good health equation is also true. Negative and pessimistic feelings have been linked to poor sleep, tiredness, and health problems. So how do we feel more positive? The answer is to find perspective. There may be some things that are not as you want them to be, and it is fine to accept that. But it is irrational to only see the negative. If necessary, draw up a written list of positive things so that you can focus on the broader picture, which is that some things are difficult, but many are not. Gratitude is one emotion that a team of psychologists in California has been researching for over a decade. During a recent study, those who tried to develop a greater sense of gratitude reported fewer physical problems, such as pain, saw a positive effect on sleep and on time spent exercising, and had more optimistic expectations for the coming week. So how can we develop a feeling of gratitude? You can be thankful for anything, your family, your well-being, or just being alive. The key is to be thankful all the time, rather than only as a response to a specific event. In fact, developing a permanent sense of gratitude is essential. In studies, participants were asked to keep a weekly gratitude journal, noting down everything they felt grateful for. The result was fewer physical problems and a greater sense of optimism. Let me finish by giving you some general advice on how to manage your emotions. Most importantly, stop negative emotions in their tracks. The longer you let them control your thoughts, the longer you'll suffer, psychologically and physically. If you find yourself about to have an argument or are feeling stressed, remove yourself from the situation and find a quiet spot. Take up to 15 deep breaths. Try to calm yourself with the reassurance that all is well and you are in control. This can lower your heartbeat rate and blood pressure almost immediately. If you're having an argument, walk back into the room for a discussion. If that isn't possible, leave. It's important to reduce stress. If you're working yourself up with tight deadlines, just cross off the last three items on your to-do list. Deep breathing is a vital part of turning around your feelings. Breathe deeply for a few minutes, and you should relax and let go of worries.
That's the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.